It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it might be hard to imagine some positive things to come from polar vortex icy temperatures, but some reports have said those cold temps could kill off some of the destructive emerald ash borer population. We'll learn more from a Wisconsin entomology expert. First, when you're watching TV, is there a commercial that you just absolutely can't stand? One that makes you yell in disgust every time it comes on? Maybe you have to lunge for the remote to hit the mute button or change the channel? We asked some of our WPR colleagues around the state which commercials drive them batty and why. We got a pretty good range of responses. We'll share some in just a moment. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What TV commercial annoys you? It could be a commercial now, past, or present. Which commercials drive you nuts and why? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. Wisconsin Public Radio reporter Bridget Bowden and Central Time producer Bill Martins both said this spot makes them roll their eyes. Bridget says she's always been slightly annoyed by the Charmin bears, but this one, she says, is, quote, just, I don't know.
I'm not picking it up. You pick it up.
I'm not picking it up.
Well, somebody's got to pick it up.
I'll pick it up. They're clean.
Cuz my hand is clean. Oh, yeah, I'm Charmin clean. That's how I know they're clean.
Yeah, okay. Bridget says she laughed out loud the first time she saw that one because she thought it was so ridiculous. How about you? What is yours? What is the commercial that you just can't stand, past or present? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. WisContext Managing Editor Christian Knudsen says his top offender is for consumer cellular. I don't know if I've seen this one. He says 2 minutes is way too long. He says depending on how you look at it, it either condescends to older adults or panders to them. And he says it's glaringly non-diverse in its casting for a contemporary commercial. And we heard from a lot of you on Facebook. Meg writes, the Skittles Pox commercial. Ick. The girl picks Skittles Pox off the boy's face and eats them. It makes me gag right there with you, Meg. Can't stand that one. To your calls now at 800-642-1234. Jackson is with us in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi.
What's your commercial?
It's the Subaru commercial where the kids are at school and they have explained to their principal that their Uncle Edward has died. And they say, oh, poor Uncle Edward, he's died like six times now. And then they get into the car because they take the death to go on a family vacation.
Huh. Yeah, not wild about the message there.
So the kids act all upset and then they get into their Subaru and they're like, woohoo, going on family vacation.
Yeah, okay. And, do you lunge for the remote when you see that one coming on?
Yeah, or I just sit there patiently, or I, you know, go do something I need to do, and then it's over.
All right. Does this motivate you to not buy a Subaru?
No, I love Subarus. That's the sad part.
All right. Thank you so much for sharing that one at 800-642-1234. Looking for your least favorite commercial, the one that makes you want to turn it off. We heard from Brandy on Facebook about, she says, those stupid Mentos commercials. I remember those, haven't heard them for years. That song is still in my head. Brandy, I'm not going to take blame for this one. Our producer, Bill Martins, put this one in the mix. So write your angry letters to him, not me.
The Fresh Maker.
All right, so now that's in your head if you haven't lunged to turn the radio off. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. We've got David on the line in Milwaukee. David, hi.
Hi. I can't stand prescription drug medication commercials. I can't believe that they're even allowed to advertise stuff that your doctor should be telling you need or not. And, yep, they irk me.
Just the existence, the fact that they're marketing this prescription stuff directly to people?
Yeah, like, what if doctors should tell you what you need? You should go to them with your symptoms and they should suggest that you shouldn't be asking a doctor, oh, I saw this happy lady riding her bike and I want to be like that.
I mean, there is the upside, David, of the like weird absurdity where they have the happy person riding the bike, like you said, and then 30 seconds of possible side effects ranging from like weird to gruesome. I mean, that's I don't know, kind of weird and entertaining, I guess.
The ED commercials, I guess, are kind of hilarious.
Okay. David, thank you so much for sharing that one at 800-642-1234. Crystal on Facebook writes, the General Insurance commercial, that cartoon figure and his song drive me nuts. We heard, here's one we'll give a listen to, Cricket, a WPR membership services manager, Kathy Behringer, says nothing has annoyed her more in the years, recent years than this one. I think I just saw this one the other day, I think.
Hi.
Hi.
Oh, we all just got new smartphones at Cricket.
Hi.
Hi.
Hola.
Hi.
Hi.
Okay, bye.
Bye. Bye.
It does wear thin quick. I think they're trying to recapture the what's up magic from the days of yore. Back to your calls now. We've got Kay on the line with us in Blue Mounds. Hello, Kay. What's your commercial?
Flow with Progressive Insurance. She's enough to make me go without insurance at all. If that were the only choice I had. Yes. I just makes me crazy.
Is it her delivery or what is it about poor Flo?
I think it's just her. Just to look at her is not pleasant.
Okay.
I don't know. I don't know. Maybe she's just too perky.
That is, I think, how she's been described. Kay, thank you so much for sharing that. We're asking you to share your least favorite commercial on TV, the one that makes you lunge for the remote control. Michael joins us next in Appleton. Michael, hello.
Hello.
Which commercial drives you nuts, Michael?
Yeah, the one that makes me most crazy is that 1-800-NEED-CASH-NOW one where they all get up and sing on a subway car. I think it's just an unethical... an unethical use of commercial time, and people need to learn how to spend their money better. Just irritating.
Gotcha, Michael. Thank you for sharing that. Not so much the annoyingness of the commercial itself, it sounds like, but the product being advertised, bugging at least a couple of our listeners. You can join in with yours at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Dan now in Reedsburg. Hi, Dan.
Hello there. I see mine not much on TV because I watch a lot of online, but a lot of times on YouTube they'll advertise this TikTok ad, and maybe I'm just too old to get it, but man, are they obnoxious.
So the one I keep seeing, I think it's on Words with Friends, is where somebody takes somebody's water and pours it and then jumps in the water or something like that. Is that the one you're seeing?
That's one of them, and it's about 100 of them. It's kids acting silly, but I guess I'm just too old.
Maybe. I mean, so maybe it's working for the target audience, just not you, and honestly just not me either, Dan.
Not working for me.
All right. Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Let's check this head-on one. Central Time producer Rachel Vasquez said this is the first one that came to mind when it comes to annoying commercials.
Head on, apply directly to the forehead. Head on, apply directly to the forehead. Head on, apply directly to the forehead. Head on is available without a prescription at retailers nationwide.
Wait, how do I use this thing? I'm just at a loss here. I don't know how this is going to work. I have not seen this one myself. You know what it does? I don't want to know. Actually, that's like a comedy skit. I've seen like Peter Serafinowicz and people do weird, surreal ads like that. What else do we have from our listeners here? Let's see. The head-on. And then there's this one, Relicor. I don't think I've seen this one either. It's kind of in the same vein.
Can't get rid of belly fat?
Stress raises cortisol. Cortisol increases belly fat. Relicor helps reduce cortisol. You need Relicor.
What was that?
Stress raises cortisol.
Let's fade that one. That's raising my cortisol and my stress levels. Let's go back to your calls now. Mary Jo is on the line in Madison. Mary Jo, hi.
Hi. My least favorite is the Stanton Optical ad that runs nonstop on every channel in the morning.
Yeah, what happens in that ad? Because, you know, the funny thing is, I feel like this whole conversation was started when a former colleague of ours at Public Radio here posted her annoyance with that ad on Facebook. What happens in this annoying ad?
Well, it's almost set like in the Middle Ages, and it's a guy with these big black glasses, and someone comes in and shows him on a platter these other glasses, and he looks at his dog and others, and it's like, no one likes those as well as mine. And then he goes, ah, and he knocks the thing off, and, you know, he looks at these glasses. But it is so irritating, and I think it's the same commercial. They haven't changed it much. The dog and him are in them all, and they run them, like, 6 or 8 times within the hour. I will never buy it Stanton Optical now, ever.
All right. Thanks a lot for sharing that. Thanks to everyone for their calls. There's a car dealership in the area that is often on music streaming services that I will avoid in part thanks to their ads. Not going to name names, but you can keep sharing the ads that drive you nuts or why you avoid places with ads that drive you nuts. You can do that over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up, those double-digit negative temperatures don't feel very good to us humans, but how about the insect world? A UW Stevens Point professor tells us why there might be a little silver lining to last week's cold weather. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, President Trump gave his State of the Union address last night. We'll talk to a political scientist about some of the big moments from the speech and the Democratic response. First, last week's temperatures were harsh. If you ventured outside at all, you experienced it. Temperatures capable of producing frostbite within minutes. While all that might not seem very positive, there could be one good thing coming out of it. While we pile on more layers or stick to indoor activities, some of our invasive and pesky bug species might not be able to handle it. Just how do insects endure that cold? Jamie Hubbard is an associate professor of biology at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. Her research interests are in insect biology, including life history and ecology. Jamie, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, I assume there are different answers to the question of how insects deal with cold, depending on the insect. Let's start with one that I've been seeing some reporting on, this emerald ash borer, big problem in Wisconsin, destroying a lot of trees in the state. People are saying, hey, maybe this could put a dent in their numbers?
Well, I think maybe with the polar vortex numbers that we had over the last week, might put a little bit of a dent into their population, but I don't think it's going to completely get rid of our emerald ash borer problem.
Right. Talk about how the emerald ash borer reacts to cold, how it affects its life cycle.
Well, there's a variety of factors that mechanisms that insects use to be able to deal with winter temperatures. Obviously, where they live, where it's cold, they have to be able to deal with that every year. And sometimes we do get some cold snaps like this last one that's extremely, extremely cold. But one of the things that they have going for them is that they are inside of trees, and in the winter they're overwintering as either late-stage larvae or the pre-pupa, which is right before their pupal stage where they're kind of they become inactive and they're going to become adults. And so they're actually in the tree in, like, the cambium layer and the sapwood layer. So just being inside the tree gives them some an insulative layer, some protection from the outside air temperature. Then also the sunlight on those cold days where we don't have a lot of moisture in the air, it's pretty sunny sometimes, so the sunlight hitting the trees can warm those trees up and kind of bring the temperature inside the trees up a little bit more than the outside air. So even though it feels really cold to us, it may not be all that cold, you know, to that low of a temperature inside the trees. And then snow, if we have snow cover, that can kind of reflect onto the tree and warm the trees up too. But aside from being insulated, they also have some other mechanisms that they use inside their bodies to help protect them. For one, they can do something called supercooling. And a lot of the insects that we have here in Wisconsin that have to survive over the winter do this. And what this is that they have the ability to bring their freezing temperature inside of their cells down below what is typically freezing, so they can operate at a lower temperature, and they do this by kind of extracting some of the water inside of their cells that goes out of their cells, and what's left in their cells are a lot of sugars and proteins, things that we think of as antifreezes. So it basically keeps them thawed out inside their cells while when it's really cold and freezing outside in the outside environment. They can also, and so they will actually super cool, and there's a term called the super cooling point, and that's the point at which insects can cool down their bodies and still maintain, you know, be operational, maybe not moving around too much before they can die. And so they reach this point where they will actually die due to freezing. And so for Emerald Ash Borer, that super cooling point has been found to be somewhere between 0 degrees Fahrenheit and negative 30 degrees Fahrenheit. So at 0 degrees Fahrenheit, we don't get very many Emerald Ash Borer dying, about 5% of the population. But as that temperature goes down, so to 10%, we may see about 34% of the population die. At negative 20 degrees, we might see 79% of the population die. And at negative 30 degrees Fahrenheit, we might see 98% of the population die. That still leaves 2% of the population out there. But we, I would say, like it's in Stephen's point, it got to around negative 27 degrees. So we're still going to see some populations surviving in that. But there's lots of variation in the population, so some will survive better than others at those temperatures. Again, because they're insulated and they have all these other things that are going to help protect them, these lower air temperatures may not really be a huge significant factor for killing them.
Talking to Jamie Hubbard from UW-Stevens Point, entomologists there looking at how last week's polar vortex cold weather affects insects around the state and how insects deal with cold weather in general. Okay, so I guess pretty qualified good news on Emerald Ash Borer. It probably killed many of them, but not the problem hasn't gone away. Let's talk about some other insect issues. We've talked to you before about mosquitoes, and we sometimes hear in the summer, oh, we had a mild winter, so the mosquitoes are going nuts this year. Does a hard cold like this have any kind of impact at all on the mosquito population?
Well, maybe a little bit. But again, very similar to Emerald Ash Borer, they are going to have this really low supercooling temperature. So first of all, again, they're insulated in a variety of ways. So some mosquitoes are going to survive as larvae, and they are in the water, so the water will be covered by ice, and that actually does a very good job of insulating from the outside temperature, so the water temperature is going to be much warmer. And some of them will overwinter as eggs, maybe on the ground, covered by snow, and snow is a good insulator, maybe in leaf litter, and the ground temperature is actually going to be quite a bit warmer than the air temperature. And so as adults, they may be found in leaf litter too under the snow. So as long as there's good snow cover and ice coverage before those temperatures go really far down, then they are pretty well protected from the air temperatures. But they actually can tolerate some even lower temperatures than the Emerald Ash Borer. So even down as low as negative 30 degrees Fahrenheit. Ticks, similarly, they are going to be, you know, insulated in the leaf litter and by snow coverage. So as long as there's snow coverage before those temperatures really drop significantly, then they're also going to be insulated, and they also can kind of super cool down to a certain point.
Let's get to an insect that we want to survive through the winter. Bees, how do they survive, and how do they deal with more extreme levels of cold?
Well, in natural environments, they will find cavities of various kinds to survive in. So, for example, I was out with one of my classes in the winter, and there was lots of snow cover, and we dug out some snow and dug a log out from under the snow and turned it over, and there was actually a hibernating queen bumblebee under the log, and so it was all curled up in a little cell in the soil under the log. So they will also, they'll find some kind of structure that can give them some insulation, or they may go into structures as well.
And how about for, you mentioned it, that was in nature, does the cold weather make it harder for beekeepers to keep their hives going?
I don't know a whole lot about the survivalship of bees in, for beekeepers, but I imagine, of course, the less insulated their boxes and supers are, the more difficult it's going to be for them to be able to survive the super cold temperatures.
Now, do you watch for changing proportions of insect populations with climate change? And is this something that could maybe be slowed down by peaks of cold weather like this?
Yeah, definitely. So, of course, as our winter temperatures, so we have a tendency to see shorter winters now compared to, 50 years ago, maybe not quite as the cold temperatures, not quite for the super long duration. So what we see is some insects that used to live more in the south are starting to kind of creep their way up into the Wisconsin area. So they may not be as cold adapted as the insects that are native to Wisconsin. And so those are ones that we might see being really pushed back by these super cold temperatures, when we get these super cold temperatures on occasion.
What kind of insects do you watch for moving north from the south?
Of course, I'm looking for mosquitoes. That's one of the things I'm very interested in. So there are a few mosquitoes coming up from the south. One of them is the Asian tiger mosquito, and it has been reported in southern Wisconsin to some extent. And it's mostly, I don't think it's very cold adapted. I don't know for sure, but the fact that it is just now reaching this more northern climate tells us something about climate change and about the migration of this insect. But then also these kinds of temperatures are probably going to have a little bit of impact on them. But they, as our winters just keep getting more mild and shorter, we are going to see that mosquito probably move its way up north.
Is there a worry that having extra new different kinds of mosquitoes could lead to them carrying extra new different kinds of diseases with them?
Most definitely. Yeah, they carry some diseases or have the ability to carry diseases that we don't have around here. So a few of the viruses that we see more southerly located, we could find up here.
Jamie, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Okay, thank you so much. I appreciate that.
That's Jamie Hubbard, Associate Professor of Biology at UW-Stevens Point. Her research interests are in insect biology, including life history and ecology. She joined us today to talk about how polar vortex temperatures affected insect populations. For the most part, at least for the Wisconsin insects, not that much. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a political scientist about last night's State of the Union address, and you can call in and tell us what you thought about what the president had to say and the Democratic response as well. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there are plans to slow down the closure of the Lincoln Hills School for Boys and Copper Lake School for Girls. We'll get the latest, including plans from the governor to boost staffing at the youth prisons. First, President Trump gave his State of the Union address last night in front of a joint session of Congress promoting a strong U.S. economy and low unemployment. Trump called for bipartisanship in his speech, but also dug in on divisive issues like abortion rights and building a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border. In the Democratic response, Stacey Abrams, former candidate for governor in Georgia, focused on the issue of voting rights and called the recent government shutdown a stunt engineered by President Trump. Lily Gorin is a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. Her books include Women in the White House and Mad Men in Politics. Lily, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on today.
Before we dig into the details, Lily, your overall impression of this State of the Union address?
It was a little long. It had a lot of different agenda points. A lot of them, things that Trump has talked about before, very long section on immigration. But it wasn't necessarily a State of the Union where you could say, okay, this is where the Trump administration is going to go next. And a lot of the time presidents, after they give a State of the Union address with a lot of policy points, will often go out into the country advocating for particular aspects of that agenda. And that's, again, how to sort of capitalize on the State of the Union. Obviously, Trump does things a little differently with regard to use of social media. He doesn't do a lot of that sort of going to sell his policy plans per se, the way previous presidents have. And so it's not clear also if he will capitalize on the State of the Union through Twitter the way he often uses it.
Now, legal immigration and the border wall were a big part of the speech. No surprise. Here's a little of what the president had to say.
Working class Americans are left to pay the price for mass illegal immigration. Reduced jobs, lower wages, overburdened schools, hospitals that are so crowded you can't get in, increased crime, and a depleted social safety net.
So the president saying, hey, working class people are affected by illegal immigration. The political class doesn't understand this. What do you make of him framing border security along those lines?
And this is, you know, this is sort of how he has often approached some of the questions around border security and immigration in general, that it is about jobs for Americans who are here, and that, you know, that there's a tension between people who are coming to the United States and wanting to have jobs or lives here. And so this is not necessarily a new approach. And I think we also heard some of this from the president when he gave, a primetime address during the government shutdown, talking about the need for the wall and immigration reform.
A strange moment in the address. The president, talking about the value of legal immigration, said he wanted to see legal immigration at higher levels than before. I've read that was an ad lib from the original prepared remarks. Did that surprise you?
That did, because he and other members of his administration have actually called for lower levels of legal immigration. And so given that it was an ad lib, it wasn't in the speech itself, and it's not necessarily something that I've heard from him clearly articulated in that way before.
In the Democratic response, Stacey Abrams, a former candidate for governor in Georgia, addressed the issue of border security as well. Here's some of what she had to say.
We know bipartisanship could craft a 21st century immigration plan, but this administration chooses to cage children and tear families apart. Compassionate treatment at the border is not the same as open borders. President Reagan understood this. President Obama understood this. Americans understand this.
With what we're hearing from both sides, do you expect to see any kind of actual compromise on border security?
There may be a compromise bill that comes out of the House and the Senate and the Democrats and Republicans. Whether the president will sign it remains to be seen. But, you know, the State of the Union address didn't necessarily provide a clear sort of parameter that the president said, okay, I'm willing to give this for this. We didn't hear that in the State of the Union address. We did hear again about his desire to have a structural wall on the southern border, and a lot of discussion again about the southern border of the United States. And so that is where his focus has been with regard to an immigration sort of deal.
Talking to Lily Gorin from Carroll University, looking at the State of the Union address last night. You can join in with your reactions at 800-642-1234. Now, talking about the health of the economy, a lot of attention to this here. President Trump put in a mention of the Mueller investigation and possible House Democratic investigations. Here's a listen.
An economic miracle is taking place in the United States, and the only thing that can stop it are foolish wars, politics, or ridiculous partisan investigations.
And he reiterated that point. What do you make of the president directly addressing the investigations of his campaign, his presidency, and so on?
Well, he's groused about the investigations essentially since he was elected. And there was some investigation, you know, early on that catapulted into the Mueller probe. And so he's been complaining about them for some time. And, you know, he's sort of continues to complain about them. At the same time, now you have the change of the majority in the House, and the House will have this power that it was not used for the most part by the Republicans when they were in the majority during the Trump administration to investigate some of the questions with regard to cabinet members and the campaign and so forth. But, you know, the Republican Congress did spend a lot of time during the Obama administration investigating a variety of things, including things like the Benghazi incident and so forth. Investigations by Congress and oversight are one of their responsibilities.
We've already seen a tweet since then from the president targeting House Democrat Adam Schiff, a key figure on a key committee here. We've seen a House Democratic committee share some of their interview materials now with the Mueller probe and pledging to go ahead with investigations along, I think, five different fronts related to President Trump, his campaign, and his business. Are we going to see a lot of action in the House now, do you think?
I have a feeling that the Democratic committees, a lot of them will be moving forward with a variety of investigations. And again, not just necessarily of President Trump and the campaign and so forth, but there's also been, you know, a number of cabinet and sub-cabinet members who have had some questionable sort of travel and so forth. And they may also, I think, come under some investigation as well.
Healthcare was also touched on last night. President Trump said it was going to be a top issue going forward. Here's one of his priorities.
The next major priority for me and for all of us should be to lower the cost of healthcare and prescription drugs and to protect patients with pre-existing conditions.
And Stacey Abrams in the Democratic response raised some of the same issues. Let's look at that prescription drug cost issue. Is this one thing where actually there could be some bipartisan cooperation?
In terms of healthcare, that is certainly an area where there's been a lot of discussion, and Congress has been sort of paying attention to this and has already held some hearings with regard to some of the elevated costs of high-profile drugs and so forth. And so I think this may be an area where, you know, there is comedy between members of Congress, the president, and that they may be able to forge an alliance on looking at and trying to figure out how to reduce some of the costs of prescription drugs.
Now, protecting patients with pre-existing conditions, though, that exists under the Affordable Care Act, which is still around in a somewhat modified form now, but it's there already. So that's I don't know. There's not necessarily room for cooperation on that.
No, I mean, this seems to be an area of policy that was a real sort of key point of the Affordable Care Act during the Obama administration. And it's one that members and senators have run on in terms of, you know, continuing to strengthen healthcare policy and make sure that pre-existing conditions are protected as an area that, you know, that health insurance cannot throw you off because of them or other outcomes. So in that regard, there's, you know, this does exist. There is some concern that if you sort of continue to strip away at aspects of the Affordable Care Act, that includes getting rid of the protections for pre-existing conditions.
We're talking to Lily Gorin right now, professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University, looking back at last night's State of the Union address. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you watch? Did you listen? Did you read about it afterward? What were your takeaways from last night's speech from President Trump and the Democratic response from Stacey Abrams? Are there areas where you think the president and Democrats in Congress could work together, should work together? Do you think a potential government shutdown this month is more or less likely based on what you heard? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about last night's State of the Union address. Lily Gorin is with us, professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What did you think of President Trump's speech last night, the tone he struck, the issues he chose to focus on, or what wasn't in the speech? Do you think anything can get done now with a divided Congress? And what do you think of the Democratic response from Stacey Abrams? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Chris is with us in Beaver Dam. Chris, hello.
Hi, yeah, I thought that the State of the Union was actually pretty outstanding. I think he made points more succinctly and more, that you can actually understand than he has through Twitter and other media. And I think he did indicate a compromise. He talked about protecting 1.8 Dreamers, and that's way more than the 900,000 that have registered under DACA. And I think that the Democrat response is just another stall. They don't actually want to work together with anybody if it actually produces an outcome. And this is a divided Congress. You have to work together, which means, not pounding fists on the wall, but actually sitting down and working toward a solution, which I hope they get to.
Chris, thanks a lot for calling in. Lily, he says, okay, President Trump has put this compromise on the table involving Dreamers. He did that in a speech earlier as well. Is this a starting point? We've been close to here before, it seems like.
Yeah, and I think that this is, again, part of the legislation that was put together by the House and the Senate before the end of the last Congress in December. And so you have, again, you have a divided Congress with a majority of Democrats in the House and a majority of Republicans in the Senate. So whatever is going to come out in terms of a compromise has to make it through both those houses with those two different majorities and also make it to the president's desk for his signature. And so it's not always been clear that the Republicans in the Senate are totally on board with where the president wants to go. And that's also been part of the complicated nature of this particular issue area and the way that our system works, which is, again, we don't have a parliamentary system. So you have, divided government in a variety of structural ways as well as partisan ways.
Chris, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Chris also thought that President Trump used the speech and the venue to make his points, he said, more concisely and clearly than, say, in his tweets or maybe than in his rallies over time. This is a different kind of speaking environment than we often see from President Trump.
It is a different form of speaking, as you say, because it's not a rally. It is the formal setting of the House of Representatives with, the chamber full with members of the Supreme Court there and the cabinet and invited guests. Obviously, the First Lady, who was given a call out by the president and had her, her box with a number of high profile individuals who the president acknowledged during the course of the speech, which has been a, sort of part of the State of the Union since Ronald Reagan started to sort of do that during his State of the Union addresses. But this, this speech was almost as long as the longest speech, State of the Union speech, which was given by Bill Clinton during his administration. And again, that takes into account how many times people stand up and how long the ovations are. But it was not a sort of 45-minute speech. 45 minutes was about halfway through it.
We heard from a caller named Kay who is wondering how the president can make the case that the ongoing Mueller probe and congressional investigation would impact the economy. Do you see a connection there?
I don't know exactly how the Mueller probe would per se impact the economy, but there is discussion that if the president does move to shut down the government again, that can have adverse effect on the economy.
Talking to Lily Gorin from Carroll University in Waukesha, looking at last night's State of the Union address. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. AJ is with us in Green Bay. AJ, hello.
Hi there. I wasn't making a comment about the previous caller about how
he's blaming the Congress for stall. Isn't that the pot calling the kettle black? When President Obama was in office and then the Republicans took over Congress and everything, isn't that exactly what they did? And all of a sudden, well, now everything's the president's fault. Well, you can't have it both ways.
AJ, thanks a lot for the call. When you look at an issue like judicial nominees, say, Lily, we've definitely seen stalling from whichever side doesn't have the presidency, right?
You have seen some, but there are also moves to change some of the structures and processes in the Senate. And so you have also seen quite, you know, Donald Trump has a record now of nominating and having confirmed more judges and justices in the federal bench at this point in his presidency, I think, than any previous president.
Is that because of structural changes in the Senate to streamline that?
And the fact that that's an area where he has, you know, been very fast to nominate lots and lots of people. And the majority in the Senate, the Republican majority in the Senate, has moved through a lot of those nominees and confirmed them. One of the points that the president brought up during the course of his speech was that there has been a lag in terms of the confirmation of people to executive positions, but the Trump administration has also been quite slow in nominating people to the second and third level of executive positions. And so there are still quite a few, say, ambassadorialships that remain unfilled by the Trump administration.
Let's bring on another caller now. Ben is with us in La Crosse. Ben, hi.
Hi. I guess I was listening earlier to a gentleman caller who was speaking about how he thought the president was being more concise about his objectives and his speech. And I would disagree. It just appeared to me as he was rehashing everything he had promised to do, but yet was unsuccessful in completing.
Ben, thanks for the call. So rehashing things Ben says that the president has been talking about, maybe even since he was on the campaign trail.
I mean, again, you had about a sixth of the speech that was on immigration, you know, and it was a lot of different aspects of immigration and included highlighting a variety of personal stories that the president wanted to draw attention to, which is, again, what presidents do in terms of policy areas. And immigration and the border wall have been, you know, part of Donald Trump's sort of campaign and his presidency since the very beginning. And so that section of the speech was, you know, something that many of us have read or heard from Donald Trump over the course of the last 3 years. Other aspects were, you know, a little bit different. He did, you know, sort of talk about the more women being employed. And of course, there was the sort of groundswell in the House among the newly elected women House members and so forth. And there was a lot of discussion in the speech also about World War II. We had quite a few World War II veterans there that he drew attention to. So there was also a kind of nostalgic referencing to other times when the United States had triumphed.
In our last minute or so, Lily, regardless of who the president is, we make a lot of hullabaloo in the state about the State of the Union, the big ceremony, lots of media coverage, lots of conversations like this one. Do they really change anything? Do they move the conversation very much?
They can sometimes, but again, it's usually when the speech is also sort of followed by a lot of very precise moves to enact the agenda. So did the Trump administration move forward with its allies in Congress with very specific bills that, again, are, say, talking about funding for AIDS, HIV research and eradication that he did highlight and mention in the speech? Are there other pieces of legislation that moved through Congress today or this week that are, again, are pulling up parts of the speech that he gave last night? And so it's, you know, it is a speech, but then it's also this question of agenda setting and moving forward to sort of enact policy.
Lily, thanks a lot for joining us again.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Lily Gorin is a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. She was with us to look back at President Trump's State of the Union address last night. Later in the show, we'll talk more about the key points from last night with two guests from differing political viewpoints, and we'll ask you to join the conversation again as well. And you can join it right now if you'd like electronically. You can email ideas@WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page what stood out to you the most about the president's address and or the Democratic response to it. If you are in the dating world, there's a decent chance you've tried one of the many dating apps out there on the market. And maybe it's got you down at some point, and maybe one of the things is the way it works. You get a picture of a person, and you put up a picture of yourself. And you know, pictures can be misleading, and maybe it's superficial to judge someone just by a picture of what they look like. Well, how about this? How about, you know, judging your potential date based on a picture of the inside of their refrigerator? It's supposedly called Refriger Dating. The Samsung company has come out with an app to do this. You post a picture of the inside of your fridge and then try to match up with someone else with similar interests based on, I don't know, hey, look, you like kale, I like kale. Your fridge is a disaster area with just a few swizzle sticks and some bacteria, mine too. Hey, we both like craft beer, I don't know. So you can do this, supposedly, and it's kind of attached to the rollout of a new smart fridge that costs somewhere between 8 and 12 times as much as I would pay for a refrigerator, and it has more internet connectivity than I want a refrigerator to have, which is zero. And it raises questions, too, like, well, didn't you just stage your fridge? Like, I don't usually have this, but I'm going to put in the fancy, I don't know what, wine, Perrier water, whatever. Let me know if you try refrigerating. I bet you haven't. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.